We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy. How are you today, Lynn?
I'm good. Happy to be here. How are you?
I'm excellent. Great to have you back. So several guests recently have pointed out that there are fast food restaurants paying people just to come in to do an interview, bringing up the point that many entry-level workers are now making more money to be on unemployment than to be in the workforce. So with all the stimulus checks sent out to Americans, what is the prospect for the employment rate starting to see real growth again?
So it's starting to inch up. It's certainly better than it was before. We saw, you know, one of my kind of calls from back in say, April 2020, was that the labor market would probably see a backward square root sign recovery. So everyone was talking about the V-shaped recovery, everything falls off a cliff and then bounces back. And I said, no, like with jobs, there's kind of a more realistic cycle to play out. And so you had that big sharp fall, you had a snapback when you had, you know, started to get the reopening after the initial shutdowns. But instead of going all the way back up to where it was before, payroll started rolling over and going sideways. So you can visualize it like a backward square root sign. And we've been in that phase for several months. It looks like we might gradually be starting to break out of that and finally get, you know, closer to some job growth here. But we still have a long way to go, in the United States to reach the previous total employment levels. And so the unemployment rate in some ways is understating the actual employment issues. Because some people have just permanently left the labor market. And so if you look at, you know, labor participation rate and employment to population ratio, which is the total number of employed people, that's still pretty far below the previous highs set, you know, right before the pandemic. And so there's kind of different factors of the stimulus that can impact that. And so generally the one-time stimulus checks don't have a large impact on that because it's like a one-time burst of income. They don't know if they're going to get another one. They get it whether or not they're employed, as long as they're under, you know, like say upper middle, like a middle class, you know, kind of lower end of upper middle class, they get that check anyway. Whereas some of the extra unemployment benefits that specifically go to unemployed people, because those are higher than normal, to accommodate the fact that so many people were unemployed, some of those do have kind of, you know, problematic incentives when it comes to, lower wage people going back to work at jobs that, you know, from their perspective, they're just kind of maximizing their value to time ratio by not really necessarily seeking out jobs. And this should start trailing out, you know, towards the end of the year when some of those, effects wear off, those checks.
Mm-hmm. So does this also have other unintended consequences elsewhere, considering that this number can also affect how other metrics of the economy are calculated, Lynn?
Well, it's one of those things where it certainly can have some inflationary forces because you're increasing the amount of broad money supply, you're increasing personal incomes without necessarily increasing, goods and services and people are able to produce those. So that goes back to, you know, if we go back all the way to the great financial crisis, banks were largely bailed out, whereas the public, you know, pretty much got almost nothing. And so that kind of changed the culture that brought out sort of populist movements. Basically, people kind of pushed back on that. And now when we went into this crisis that affected the broader economy more, people were kind of like, you know, not going to have that, you know, kind of selective bailout thing. And so we got a broader thing where, you know, some people got checks, they didn't need it, but other people lost their job and they got this much needed lifeline. And it's kind of across the board. And so whenever you have a policy mix that's that big, you're certainly going to have unintended consequences. You're going to have areas of fraud. You're going to have areas of excess. You're going to have all sorts of issues. And so, for example, we're seeing semiconductor shortages. We're still seeing supply chain issues related to, you know, the pandemic, related to the shutdowns, related to the fact that, you know, consumer demand shifted, more quickly than average because of the changing environment. So, you know, people stayed home more. They did more home remodeling. They moved to the suburbs. So we got lumber shortages, housing boom and things like that. Whereas you have shortages in other areas. And so, there's kind of a broad range of issues that can happen whenever you have a big, you know, policy mix like this.
So if we think about this in a broader context, Lynn, what parts of GDP are most likely to rebound the most this year? And how do we position ourselves to kind of capitalize on that growth?
So if you look at, 2020, a lot of the cyclical industries were depressed, and the tech stocks did very well because people were, forced at home and basically using those tech companies. As we look out into the later part of 2021 and 2022, some of those more cyclical things are doing very well and likely to, continue doing pretty well. And so you have a rebound to some degree in tourism and hospitality, but there's still a lot of issues where they came into it with a lot of debt. And so that debt didn't go away. And so even though they got aid and things like that, you want to watch out for the weaker ones that might not make it. You can also look at restaurants, things like that. Basically, a lot of them have gaps in their earnings, for last year, this year, even because they're still not operating at full capacity. Right. So, you can benefit from the speculation, but you still have to kind of look close to the fundamentals, because even some of the ones that recovered in stock price, didn't necessarily recover in fundamentals. And so overall, you should just see more kind of activity that contributes to GDP, but that might or may not correlate to those equity sectors performing similarly, because you can have revenue rebound, you can have more activity rebound, you can start passing on prices to consumers, but your bottom line is still impacted if you're below kind of normal capacity levels. And so also government spending is a part of GDP, and that's remaining elevated. Here in 2021, a big thing to watch in multiple countries, including the United States, is what's going to happen with infrastructure spending, right? Because that will affect, all sorts of different facets to the economy. That'll impact GDP numbers, for a multi-year period or not if it's not passed. And so we have to kind of watch the political movements around those to get an idea of how that might impact some of the economic data and what asset classes could do well.
So Lynn, you recently wrote an article entitled How Market Capitalization Works. And in it, you point out that the biggest threat to the US equity market capitalization at these atypically high levels would be a reversal of some or all of these trends. Can you give us kind of a summary of what those trends would be?
Sure. So basically, we've been in kind of a long-term secular bull market since the early 1980s, especially in the United States, but to some extent in other countries as well. And the way that worked is, we had we started from a period of high interest rates and low valuations. So as interest rates come down, valuations went higher and higher. We started to run big fiscal deficits. We had very large, trade deficits. So those trade deficits, we basically offshored a lot of our manufacturing base. The United States did this more than, say, Europe, more than Japan, more than other developed peers, essentially. We had a faster degree of offshoring, so we widened our trade deficits, and then the foreign sector took those dollars, and from their perspective, dollar surpluses, and they reinvested those initially in treasuries mostly, but then they increasingly began investing in corporate equities as well, U.S. equities, and so they take their dollars to go back and buy a lot of our assets, and that contributed to U.S. equity outperformance, higher valuations. And so we have this big kind of virtuous like feedback loop where, at least for asset prices, right? So it's really bad if people, for people that lost their job due to that process. But from an asset price standpoint, that's been this kind of like, feedback loop that just kind of keeps pushing valuations ever higher. And then we also had an issue where, because of that offshoring, because of tax cuts, mainly for corporations, because of things like that, if you look at the labor share of GDP compared to corporate profits as a percentage of GDP, corporations have taken a larger share over the past 15 years or so. And so that might or might not be sustainable. Basically that kind of thing can have political pushback. We're starting to see that show up in the narratives, more and more, where we're talking about potential corporate tax increases. We're talking about reshoring manufacturing supply chains in some areas. And so if that narrative and that policy starts changing, that's another headwind. And so basically, we've had this kind of perfect storm of higher valuations, lower interest rates, lower corporate tax rates, offshoring that then put all those, kept costs low and then recycled those dollars back into propping up the equity valuations. And so if you start to get, tax increases, if you start to get interest rate increases, or at least long duration bonds kind of, not going down anymore and maybe going sideways to up instead, that can reverse some of these trends. And then if we also, change policy mix to address the trade deficit, then that big feedback mechanism can slow down or stop. And so generally speaking, if you zoom out, the equity markets that do well in one period of time you know, after a long enough stretch, they get very expensive, and a lot of those feedback loops kind of break down. And usually in the next decade, other equity markets do well. And so it's basically, we want to watch for potential rotations if U.S. equities kind of hit like a peak and then kind of have trouble sustaining that level.
So something you pointed out, Lynn, in your recent newsletter was the importance of how people often look at most financial metrics in a year-over-year term, comparing this year's numbers to last year's numbers. And a great example of this was the CPI numbers that recently came out. And because of the low numbers reported for March and April of 2020, they look dramatic when comparing them to numbers from this year. So is the growth in the CPI numbers likely to continue like this?
So it's a little bit of both. And so, you know, when we had the March number, it was compared to basically there was a dip in CPI back in the spring of 2020, because that's when we had kind of the harshest period of the lockdowns, the pandemic. China was locked down, the United States was locked, you know, so all these different places shut down, and so CPI dipped. And so, you know, if you did say a February to February comparison, that was before that happened, really. So you didn't really have that dip yet. So the year-over-year data was not particularly interesting. When you look at March compared to March of last year, that's more interesting. But it's really not until April and May and June that it gets super low. And that's, of course, reported in May, June, and July. So the April CPI, for example, is not even out yet. And so the year-over-year April numbers are probably going to be, you know, pretty high, certainly above the Fed's kind of long-term target. And the Federal Reserve's aware of that. And so they're kind of getting ahead of that narrative by talking about these transient inflation effects. But the issue is when you have those very easy base effects, and then you have, you know, some actual, like, you know, the policy mix that is pushing up commodity prices, that is pushing up a bunch of different, we're starting to see, you know, Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble talk about price increases. A lot of that is starting to kind of layer on inflationary pressures on top of those base effects. And so you can get some, you know, pretty interesting headline year-over-year CPI numbers as you look out into April, May, June, July timeframe. Now, how persistent it is will partially depend on, you know, what happens with, commodity demand, right? So a lot of the commodity demand, we often think of the United States, but, you know, China is the biggest importer of a lot of commodities. So that'll partially depend on Chinese credit cycle, their continued growth. As you look out a little bit further, we're talking about India's commodity consumption as they, you know, likely continue to grow as a percentage of global GDP. And then, you know, then it comes back to fiscal stimulus and ongoing infrastructure spending, because, you know, we've had this big injection of capital. But say if you were to stop right now, we could go back into a disinflationary trend. But if you do another round of that, you know, infrastructure spending, that's more commodity demand, that's more money entering the economy, then you can actually sustain inflation for maybe longer than policymakers think. Another way to look at it is that, you know, what they call transient inflation doesn't necessarily mean that the prices come back down. It means that the rate of change of inflation might not be, you know, it's not going to last as long as it is during this, you know, particularly hot period. But that once those prices get to that level, you know, they're not going to come back down. And so at least not all of them. For example, lumber is probably going to come back down at some point. But if you look at a broad enough set of prices, they'll zoom up to a higher level. And that's a new kind of plateau for them. And so if you look at, say, the 1940s, you had these three really big inflationary spikes. And, you know, it wasn't just this persistent period of inflation. It was these three notable spikes. But then after the spike was over, prices just stayed at those levels. They didn't go back down. It's not like you spiked and went back down in prices. So there's a difference between transient inflation in rate of change terms and transient inflation in absolute terms. And so that's kind of how I'm looking at it, where these prices are, you know, not going to change at the same pace they have been probably, but they're not going to come back down either in aggregate.
So Lynn, as we consider all of this, why could Q3 start to get pretty rough, as you've said?
Well, so at that point, that because we're, you know, quarter two is where you're, you know, the economy bottomed in quarter two of last year. And so the year-over-year numbers are really good for that period. And so, you know, as corporations report quarter two results, they're comparing it to the worst part of the pandemic. And so they have great year-over-year numbers. Some of the quarterly economic data looks good. But then as we look out into the second half of this year, quarter three is not going to be as good in rate of change terms, because quarter three of last year wasn't as bad as quarter two by a long shot. We already started to rebound by then. And then if you talk about, you know, potential for corporate tax increases. Infrastructure stimulus gets gridlocked, right? So that's, you know, the market's kind of saying, well, show me what's next. Show me what's next. It's like, you know, we had our one fix and now it's like, you know, what's next? And if the answer is nothing's next, or if the answer is that there's a mix of things that are, you know, good and bad, you know, like say infrastructure spending could be boosting for, you know, money supply, could be boosting for profits and things like that. But if that's accompanied by higher taxes and things like that, well, that's kind of a mixed bag compared to the fact that the previous rounds of stimulus was all spending and, you know, just deficit driven. And so basically the news starts to get a little bit mixed, you know, muddled as we go later in the year, especially because we've already had very, very high, you know, rate of change here. We've had a huge growth spurt. We've had a big increase in margin debt in a pretty short period of time. We have a lot of speculation and things, you know, all the way down to Dogecoin. And so that type of euphoria is tough to maintain for more than a couple quarters.
So Lynn, as we're talking about CPI and inflation here, in your opinion, is CPI an accurate measurement of inflation? And if not, how would you change it?
The short version is I don't think it's particularly accurate in the past few decades. I think there was a period of time where it was more accurate. The inherent challenge there is that, you know, you're measuring a basket of goods. You're trying to do quality adjustments, right? So, you know, a Toyota Camry is not the same as a Toyota Camry from 10 years ago. And then it's like, well, how do we offset the price increase based on the fact that it's more like a spaceship now than a car? And so, you know, you have these kind of inherent things that are challenging. There's also a weird factor where, you know, a house is the biggest expense for a lot of people. And yet a house is not in the CPI directly because that's considered a capital good. So instead you have owner's equivalent rent, which is based on like surveys of like what you theoretically could rent your dwelling for. And then you have issues where, you know, the median home price went up faster than CPI over the past, 30 years. And then even when you factor into you do a quality adjustment, you say, okay, homes are about 15% larger. So we factor that out. It's still higher than CPI. But then if you factor in, say, the fact that the mortgage rate 30 years ago in the United States was 10% and now it's like 3%, the actual monthly cost of that home only went up about, say, 1.5 times, which is actually lower than CPI. And so if something goes up in price a ton, but then the financing it costs go down, does that mean that we didn't have inflation? Not really, but that's kind of how it shows up in the CPI. And so when you look at, you know, the big chunks of where people spend their money, such as buying a house, healthcare, tuition, childcare, and food, I think a pretty representative sample of products and services probably went up higher than CPI over the past, 2 to 3 decades.
So Lynn, as we're considering all of this again, and we know that Jerome Powell is saying that he's trying to target something just above 2% inflation, what do you think the chances of them hitting that target and remaining right around it will be looking out, let's say, the next 3 to 5 years?
So they're starting to, CPI hit over 2% this latest quarter. They use PCE, which is a little bit different. Their plan is to basically overshoot for a period of time. You know, they, from the way that they measure it, you know, they want 2% for their indicator. The average of the past, 9 years has been a little bit below 2%. So now they want to go a little bit above 2% for a period of time to kind of, in their view, average that out. And so we're likely to, you know, notably overshoot next couple months, right? So we're already starting to overshoot. As you get into those April and May and June base effects, you're probably going to overshoot. They're going to, stick to the narrative that's transitory. And in some ways, like due to the rate of change, it will be. But then the question is how sticky is it after that? I do think that they're going to be able to, overshoot their target for a while. But I don't know if they're going to be able to cleanly, keep it at 2.5% or whatever they want to do. I think you could have a part where it's getting notably above it, then it's coming back down. And then the actual, quote unquote, real number will be probably higher than what that metric is suggesting. But that'll largely depend on what's happening with house prices, right? Because, like I said, that's a huge component of it. We'll also have to watch healthcare costs and tuition costs, things like that. And so I do think that, this is going to be a period where, interest rates are going to be at, near zero for still quite some time, while inflation is running, somewhat above their targets. And so that's kind of the big rock and a hard place that investors have, is that many, many assets are very expensive, but then also cash is failing to keep up with, you know, cost of living.
I think an important distinction that I've heard you make in the past was the expansion of the base money in this case in the past year. So can you tell us a little bit more about why that has had different effects in the economy versus QE just expanding?
Sure. So basically, you know, there's base money and broad money. So base money is, it refers to the monetary base. So that's currency in circulation plus bank reserves. And that's a pretty small, you know, that's basically, especially the bank reserve portion, that's like wholesale money. That's where banks deposit their money at the Fed. That's not like, you know, the public's, you know, money. Then there's broad money, which consists of currency in circulation, savings accounts, checking accounts, and other cash equivalents. And that's the money that people actually have, you know, in their name, that it's like owed to them. And so if you look back in the previous crisis, the great financial crisis, you had a rapid increase in, base money, right? Because we recapitalized the banks. And so we increased all that, but there was no transmission mechanism to get that out into the economy. The only way you turn base money into broad money is either banks have to lend it, and they don't actually, you know, they don't deplete their reserves to lend it. They just multiply their reserves to lend it. But basically, there wasn't a lot of bank lending. If anything, you were drawing back and being more careful with credit. Or two, the government can run massive deficits that are monetized. And that basically gets, you know, essentially, you know, QE goes out into the public rather than getting stuck in the banking system. And so because you didn't really have large fiscal, stimulus back then, you had things like cash for clunkers. You know, you had kind of, around the margins, you had some fiscal stimulus, but it was nothing like we saw in 2020. So if you look back then, we saw a big increase in bank reserves, base money, but we did not see a big increase in broad money. Pretty much if you look at broad money, you could barely tell anything happened that year. It just kind of kept growing at the same pace it always was. Whereas if you look at 2020, because we actually had all those transmission mechanisms largely on the fiscal side, we had the stimulus checks, we had the PPP loans that turned into grants, we had selective corporate bailouts, we had extra unemployment benefits. Basically, that money got directly into checking accounts, savings accounts, currency in circulation held by the public. And so we actually had the biggest year-over-year increase in broad money since World War II. And so that's generally a more stimulatory, more inflationary response than just bank reserves going up without the, you know, associated broad money.
Excellent, Lynn. So since the last time you and I have spoke, we've seen a rise in yields. And you've explained that they have been tracking inflation expectations. And typically gold bugs think of the yellow metal as an inflation hedge, but you make an interesting distinction of gold is actually a hedge against negative real yields. So can you explain this distinction to our listeners, please?
Exactly. So, you know, if you have, say like you're in the 80s, right? So inflation was, you know, pretty high in the 80s, but gold still did very poorly because one, it did very well, you know, in 1980 itself, like at the end of the 70s. So it was in that kind of bear market. And two, because even though inflation was still kind of hot in the 80s, yields were above inflation. And so you got a positive real yield on your treasuries. And so, for example, if inflation is, 4%, but a treasury yield, a 10-year treasury yield gives you 7%, well, then you have a 3% positive real yield. And so the opportunity cost of holding a yieldless asset like gold is pretty high, and therefore it's somewhat less attractive. That's basically a strong currency dynamic. On the other hand, if inflation is only, 2%, but your yield is 1% on your treasury, well, then you're getting a negative 1% real yield in your treasury. And so even though inflation is not super high, that's a really unattractive, it's unattractive to hold cash, it's unattractive to hold treasuries, where suddenly that scarce yieldless asset looks a lot better. That basically, if you look at 50 years of data, gold has quite a strong correlation in rate of change terms with real yields. And so even during the inflationary 1970s, you know, the two spikes where gold did particularly well was when real yields hit their bottoms. And then the periods where gold corrected was also because real yields were rising somewhat. They were becoming less negative. And so what we saw from 2018 to 2020 was that real yields based on, you know, the 10-year treasury minus the TIPS market break-even rates for inflation. That's what the gold market follows kind of in real time. And so we saw that fall from 1% to negative 1%, and it bottomed around August 2020. And that even though inflation was kind of heating back up a little bit, nominal yields actually rose faster than break evens. And so you started to get a rising real yield, even though it was from a very low base. It was still negative. It was just less negative than before. So combined with the fact that gold did very well recently, that there's a lot of euphoria around it, gold started entering a correction for several months. Now, what we've seen over the past month or so is that long duration treasuries have kind of flattened out somewhat. They've come back down a little bit, while inflation now is starting to heat up more. And so real yields have gone back down to some extent. They're still not quite as low as they were back in August 2020, but they are headed in that direction. While we've also seen somewhat of a bounce in gold, so that inverse correlation is continuing. And the interesting thing is, as you look at these base effects, if we do get some interesting, headline CPI numbers, especially if they overshoot expectations, that could be a decent environment for gold, because it's unlikely that treasury yields are going to be able to keep up with that, with those, CPI changes from these base effects. So this is something I'm watching. I'm still, long-term bullish on gold here, but basically the timing of that's going to follow what happens with real rates.
That's an excellent distinction you make, Lynn. But when we look out at the 2020s, let's say, and the outlook for commodities, what factors are piling up in their favor?
So one is the long-term CapEx cycle. And so there are periods of time where, commodities are scarce, the prices are good, companies pour money into finding new deposits of things, they spend all that money to get that out of the ground. Then they oversupply the market, or there's some sort of, demand destruction. Like, in the 2000s, for example, we had a very strong commodity market, but then eventually China slowed down, right? So we some of those projections for commodity demand, flattened. And so then in the 2010s, we entered a period of commodity oversupply, especially in the oil markets. And so that basically, gave us a structural bear market for commodities that lasted quite a while. But as you look out in the 2020s, there's not, oil CapEx is way lower than it was years ago. Copper is interesting because despite having, a decent amount of CapEx, they're not finding giant new deposits in the same way that they were. And so that's a pretty tight market the longer you look out. A number of other commodities are kind of in a similar area. And so if we start to get a policy mix that focuses more on fiscal stimulus than on monetary stimulus, if you focus on potentially, moderately higher inflation levels during the 2020s, while rates are still held low and therefore real rates are somewhat negative for a lengthy period of time, if you start to see rebounding in China and India in terms of commodity demand, that all represents a pretty attractive mix for commodities as you look out into the 2020s decade. And then, if you throw in some ESG things, like there's not a lot of, interest in investing in oil companies, for example, from pension funds. And so those were some of the original, entities that sourced, for example, unprofitable shale oil. And so a lot of those companies never made free cash flow, but they had persistent demand for their equities, for their debt. That they could, kind of keep running. But now if there's less external demand from large pools of capital, then those companies are forced to be more, free cash flow positive.
Lynn, you and I have spoken before about the debt cycle, but you've also mentioned the dollar cycle. So can you give us an overview of what the dollar cycle is and how you find it instructive?
Yeah, so ever since the early 1970s, we've entered this free floating exchange rate, around the world, where the dollar and other currencies float against each other. And during that 50-year period, we've had, three big bull markets in the dollar. We've had two and a half bear markets, where the previous two times it ended in a big bear market. This time we've been in kind of an early stage of a bear market. It's still unclear how this latest cycle is going to play out. And, because the dollar is the global reserve currency, we have kind of certain dynamics with it. And so in the 70s, they made deals with Saudi Arabia and other oil producing countries to only sell their oil in dollars. And so we basically made a structure where the whole world needs dollars. So even if you're France, if you want to buy oil from Saudi Arabia, you need dollars to do it. And so we have this, this global demand for dollars that's caused structural U.S. trade deficits. And so it's kind of propped up the purchasing power, of the currency. But it's kind of, decreased our export competitiveness. And then you get these big kind of rotations in the dollar compared to other currencies based on shifting fiscal and monetary policy mix. And so, in the 1980s, we had a really big dollar spike. And then because the dollar is the global reserve currency, it's, you know, it's the global funding currency. So a lot of emerging markets, when they borrow, they basically, you know, they issue bonds or borrow from banks, it's often in dollars. And so if the dollar strengthens a lot relative to the local currencies, that causes issues. And so whenever we have these dollar spikes, you know, we have a global slowdown and use an emerging market crisis. And then that kind of, you know, eventually weighs on U.S. GDP growth as well. And so in the 1980s, we had a big dollar spike. And that was a Latin American debt crisis. They had the Plaza Accord to weaken the dollar. So we had a weaker dollar period. In the late 90s, early 2000s, we had the second dollar bull market. That caused issues for, Russia and Southeast Asia, the Asian financial crisis. Eventually that was, that was shifted in the recession we had after the dot-com bubble. We started to enter a loose fiscal policy, looser monetary policy. We got a weaker dollar. And then ever since 2015, when the previous rounds of quantitative easing ended, the dollar strengthened compared to a basket of global currencies again. So we've had slower growth. We've had, some currency issues in emerging markets. There's no particular region, but it's Argentina, it's Turkey, it's Lebanon, places like that. And so these cycles keep playing out. And the interesting thing is whenever the dollar enters one of these strong dollar periods, corporate profits generally go sideways. They have trouble continuing to grow when the whole dollar, when the whole world's kind of like, somewhat squeezed by the stronger dollar. And so generally the release valve is that the dollar goes down and corporate profits go back up. And so it's kind of a cycle that I'm watching play out to see, how's the U.S. fiscal and monetary policy mix going to affect its currency compared to some of the global peers.
So as we take that dollar cycle into consideration, as well as the commodity or the coming commodity cycle that you were mentioning as well, do you think that it's worth looking at investing in countries like, let's say, Canada and Australia, considering that they're big commodity producers?
I think so. There's somewhat of a challenge because an investor has to be familiar with their housing market because for both of those markets. Their equity markets have not been fantastic, but their housing markets have been at very high valuations, and basically didn't have the same corrections that the United States real estate market did back in the global financial crisis. And so because that's of course, tied to the banking system, there are concerns about that. But in general, when you do get, usually commodity bull markets, because they're priced in dollars and because they're levered to global growth, usually commodity bull markets are associated with dollar bear periods. And so generally that does favor commodity currencies. Some of the other ones, for example, would include the Russian ruble. That in many ways is, it's out of favor. There's concerns about sanctions. But they have very, very low leverage throughout their society, low government debt, moderately low corporate debt, pretty low household debt. And so that's actually a pretty interesting, market as well. And then if you further out on the risk spectrum, some of the South American countries are generally pretty tied to commodity cycles. So their currencies and some of their equities are quite dependent on decent, commodity prices.
So you've said that the equity market that has done well in one decade is rarely the same equity market that does excellent in the next decade. So are you looking at all of these different factors as cycles in this analysis, Lynn?
Yeah, and we have to, we don't want to kind of like look forward and say we know for sure what's going to happen and then try to fit data to fit fit that narrative. But instead, it's kind of like, here's a base case. Here's where the bottlenecks are. Here's what seems to be playing out. And then to kind of monitor to see if that trend continues. Generally when the dollar's strong, you have a period of U.S. equity outperformance until something breaks. And then it's basically the U.S. Policymakers are forced to kind of do more dovish policy. And that generally weakens the dollar. And so if you look back at different equity cycles, the 1980s, that was Japan's period of outperformance. That was their huge, they ran up into that giant bubble. In the 90s, the United States did very, very well. Europe also did quite well. In the 2000s, the US was rolling over from the dot-com bubble. The dollar was weakening. And so emerging markets, we had a commodity bull cycle. We had a weaker dollar. So we had the rise of the BRIC nations. And so we had that big narrative about these emerging markets. They got very, very overvalued in 2007. So then with the financial crisis. And then as we went out into the 2010s, we had, the strengthening dollar. And so we've had this big sideways consolidation in emerging markets. They've really underperformed, while the United States has been the big outperformer of the 2010s. And so the big open question is, what's going to be next for the 2020s? And some of the markets I like are some of the emerging markets. I also like a decent chunk of Japanese equities. And so some of the laggers over the 2010s period are some of the areas that are less bubbly, that are cheap, that have decent fundamentals as we look out in the 2020s.
Excellent, Lynn. As we wrap up here, is there anything you'd like to leave our audience with or anything you're watching really closely at this time?
I think that's the main thing. I'm watching how these base effects for inflation come in the next few months. So we'll get some interesting headline numbers, and then we have to see how the bond market responds to those numbers. Then we see that the market keeps expecting the Fed to, maybe tighten before they said they would. But then, the Fed sticks to this, it's transitory narrative. They stick to their goal of letting inflation run hot, and they're likely to, keep yields low for maybe longer than people think. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the bond market kind of behaves to that. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see some turbulence. But overall, the quarter two still looks pretty interesting for risk assets. But that as we go later into the year, that's when I get more concerned about some of these excesses that have built up in a lot of different assets at the same time as, the year-over-year comparisons start to get pretty harder as you look out into quarter three, quarter four. And so I think it's a time to, have an idea, you can have two thoughts in your head. You can have your long-term view, but then also be on the lookout for risks or excesses where things have kind of moved pretty quickly, and that, don't be surprised to see volatility later this year. And I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying some of the signs are getting a little bit concerning for some of these asset markets as you look out later into this year.
That's a great point, Lynn, is really trying to hold those two ideas in your head at the same time. I think that's really instructive and helpful in many situations in the not only the markets, but in life in general as well. Lynn, your website holds a lot of excellent content. You write some very lengthy, very in-depth articles I encourage everybody to go look at. You have a free newsletter over there as well. All of that's available at lynnalden.com, and also your Twitter feed is excellent. That's it, at Lynn Alden Contact. Lynn, thanks so very much for your time today.
Yep, thanks so much for having me.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.